This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
This is Amtower Off-Center on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Every week, speaker, consultant Mark Amtower gives you his take on what's going on in the world of government contracting. Amtower Off-Center with your host, Mark Amtower.
Welcome to Amtower Off-Center on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Mark Amtower. My guest today is Larry Tracy. Larry is NSA award-winning speaker and probably the best-known trainer in the D.C. area for oral training for contracts. Larry, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much, Mark.
Let's dive into your background a bit. I mean, I have your Shortcut to Persuasive Presentation, still available on Amazon, still one of the best books on preparing presentations out there, full of great ideas. But I also have another book where you are highlighted, The Best of the Best, where they profile great speakers, and lo and behold, there you are.
That was very nice of him to do that.
So give me a little background on Larry.
Well, I guess the defining characteristic, Mark, is I'm a retired Army colonel, and so much of what I practice in the field of speech coaching came in what I learned in the Army. I was a Latin American area specialist, but when I came out of Argentina, I was assigned to the Pentagon and the Defense Intelligence Agency. I went up and I briefed the chairman on what was happening in Argentina. The director of DIA liked it, called me up and said, I think I'm going to put you in charge of the briefing team. So you'll be in charge of briefing the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff every morning. He said, it'll be great for your career. You'll become the best known major in the Pentagon. And if you do anything to embarrass me, I'll fire you in a minute. He put it in somewhat more graphic terms. And he said, you want the job? And there was no dramatic pause in there. So, of course, I said, yes, I want the job.
Did he give you an alternative?
There was no. I mean, if I could have said, oh, no, I don't want to hurt my career. I'm dead already. So I had that job for about 2.5 years. And then went off to Bolivia as attaché, came back, went to school at Fort McNair at the Inter-American Defense College, then over to the Pentagon. Okay, that's where the next big job came in at. We were deeply involved in Central America. This was during the 1980s. And every time the Pentagon needed someone to go out and speak, because of my speaking background, I was the one. Ultimately, the White House directed the Army and the Pentagon to assign me to the State Department, and I went to State. And in the next close to 3 years before I retired, I gave almost 400 presentations around the country, most of them on college campuses, and most of them, consequently, before very difficult and frequently very hostile audiences. It was normal for me to be escorted onto the stage by campus security because of threats people were going to throw something at me. I always found the degree of satisfaction that I never had to be escorted out of the auditorium, so I think maybe I had some success. And when I retired from the Army, I figured I had this been there, done that experience and went into the field of speech coaching because I found many of the people in there were heavy on theory but maybe had never faced a real audience other than those they were training. So that's how I got into the field.
Yeah, and you know, when you think about it, speaking is literally in every facet of our lives.
Yeah, it is. So, yeah, we communicate all the time.
And we need to, but in our market, it comes into play in a variety of ways, and we're going to get the oral presentations. But let's talk generally about the power of creating a relationship through your ability to speak. Give me a couple of ideas. Here.
It is a relationship between your skills and your stagecraft. I mean, there's no question about that. But I really don't like people who teach strictly the body language and the nonverbals and downplay substance. There are some people in this field who say it's not important what you say, it's how you look and how you sound. And a lot of this comes from misinterpretation of data from a study done by a UCLA professor. When I first got into the field, I'm reading all the literature on public speaking and presentation skills. And over in every book, I find the numbers 7, 55, and 38. 7% knowledge or the concept of the words, 55% body language, and 38% voice. And that is absolute rubbish. And I felt that from the very beginning. And then finally, I found the book in England where it had an email from the originator of that, a Dr. Albert Mehrabian at UCLA. And he was very, very critical in this email he sent to the British speech coach. He said he finds it very, very uncomfortable that his findings have been so misinterpreted by amateurs who know nothing about psychology. So having said that, nonverbal communication is important, but I go with its substance and content when you're dealing with serious people. And you've got to transmit that from your brain to the brain of these people so that they hopefully do what you want them to do. Because I think all speaking, and I'm in agreement with Aristotle here, all speaking is basically persuasive. Yeah. You're trying to move someone to your position. Get them to buy in.
Well, you and I have seen each other twice this year in speaking situations. You saw me at APMP mm-hmm. as their 2013 kickoff, and then we were both speaking at a thought leadership conference a couple months back.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
If the body language was that big of a thing, I would have just flunked.
I agree with you, Mark.
I'm a pacer.
As I told you after it was over, your knowledge and your reputation that precedes it is such that no one's going to pay too much attention if you wander back and forth or you use your hands in the wrong way. And even if you say, excessively. That's one of my pet peeves is people saying, and you know. I think that just ruins a presentation. You didn't, but your style is unique to you. I wouldn't recommend it to other people, but it's just what you have to do when you're making a presentation.
Right. And for me, I guess it works because people seem to like
sure
when
well
I'm
they're
there
but, because of the knowledge they don't
right.
know anything about LinkedIn, they don't know much about selling to the government, and you're considered the guru on that, so they're going to listen. And if you do all the errors on nonverbal communication that people talk about, they're not going to be too concerned about that. They're just gobbling up that knowledge that you have.
Yeah. One of the things that I try to do when I speak is pick out some people in the audience where I can make some serious eye contact. And I like it when they're people I know, but what I'm looking for is a relatively receptive face.
That's a good psychological trick to use. And if you're speaking to a large enough audience, one of the things you can do, you pick out someone in the middle of the room, and people to their left, right, front, and center will think you're looking at them. But what you want to do is you want to look up just under the hairline, mm-hmm. and that gives the impression you're looking at all of them. So you get a 4-to-1 benefit. And in the front row, you look at that person, but then also look at the people in the back. And I think it's a good idea to divide the room into 4 quadrants and look around. Don't do it mechanically, like 1, 2, 3, 4, but mm-hmm. Still you're able to get through it that way. And then you're engaging the audience, because we are very, very big in the United States on eye contact. We want people to look at us. And when a speaker is looking at someone in the audience, they are likely to pay attention
yeah.
because they think maybe a question's going to come at them. They don't want to mess up on that.
Well, the thing for me is if I find receptive faces, and I've spoken on radio for a long time, and it's always better when I have somebody in the studio,
sure,
because we have that relationship building, mm-hmm. And it's palpable. Same thing with an audience. If I see 3 or 4 people in the audience that seem interested, my energy level goes up extremely.
And there's another side to it. If you've got someone in the audience whose their eyes are wrong and they're shaking their head, you may not want to look at them too much, because that will have just the opposite effect. You'll go in there and say, what am I doing wrong here?
Yeah.
So, yeah, it is good to pick out those friendly people. And then you have other people that are absolutely poker-faced. You don't know whether you're getting through to them or not, and some are those
there are always some of those.
Yeah, and there are some people that don't like to watch PowerPoint slides, mm-hmm. and you can imagine why. And they sort of will look away, and they're looking down because that's getting involved in it. They're oral. Mm-hmm. They listen. They get their information that way. And most audiences are going to be a mixture of the visual, the oral, and the kinesthetic, the ones who like to pick up things on it. So
yeah.
most are going to be visual. That's why PowerPoint has been so successful.
Well, we have about a minute left in the first segment, so I'm not sure I want to get started on this, but I want to talk about the elements of good speaking. One of the things, though, when I'm speaking, one of the people that I try to avoid is that person that looks like they're about to nod off.
It happened, and that was my experience when I was speaking around the campuses on it. One of the things that I did ahead of time was to call out to the university where I was speaking and talk not to the professor but to the student. And then if I determined that they were going to be a real problem, I would suggest to them, I said, listen, why don't I come out a day early and go out and have some pizza and beer, if you do that sort of thing. I'd hear the kegs popping in the background. So I'd go out and do that. And the next night when I was speaking, they became my friends because I'd established a personal relationship with them. I wasn't some remote figure coming from Washington. Mm-hmm. So I think that's anything you can do ahead of time to pre-wire.
There you go. You're listening to AmTower Off Center on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. My guest today is Larry Tracy. You can look up Larry on LinkedIn. Connect with him on LinkedIn. We'll probably touch on LinkedIn in a few minutes, but we'll be back after these messages. Welcome back to AmTower Off Center on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. My guest today is Larry Tracy. Larry is a speaking coach, a presentation coach. He helps people with speeches and with oral presentations. You can find him at Tracy, TRACY-presentation.com. Tracy-presentation.com. I suggest you do so because there's a couple of papers there that we'll be talking about in a bit that you can get from Larry by going to the website. You can also get his book, The Shortcut to Persuasive Presentations, either through the website or through Amazon. So, Larry, let's talk about the elements of good speaking here. I mean, we touched on it a little bit with the subject knowledge, et cetera. Voice certainly helps. You know, there, Francis Rose, who does the afternoon drive time show, I'd die to have his voice because mm-hmm. it's just one of those Walter Cronkite-esque yeah. authoritative things. But you and I have the voices we were born with, so we have to rely on our knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
So not that Francis doesn't have knowledge, mind you, but so give me some ideas on the elements of
I think the speaking. Most important thing when anybody is ready to make a presentation, to give an oral, so you know, there has to be structure. Because we've got so much more information in our heads than we can possibly put into a short presentation. And I think what you have to do, I teach a method of backward planning. We've learned from the time we were in elementary school on through, you do introduction, body, conclusion, ABC, 1, 2, 3, et cetera. And I recommend that people sit down, think, and then come up with what is the conclusion? What is the final phrase that they want to use to get these people that they're speaking to agree with them or to buy into them? And I call this the 3-1-2 system. So they take that essence of your message and you put it on a 3x5 card and you mark it 3. Then you take another card and you have an introduction that sort of tells your audience where you're going. And then in other cards, you put the meat of your presentation. But you start off with that as sort of your landing field, or the way a pilot will file a flight plan. He doesn't file it necessarily just from where he's taking off. He does it where he's going to land and what is the route. And backward planning, I think, will help a lot.
Start with point B in mind.
Yeah. But you work backwards on it, and then you'll see that it starts to pull together. And then as you – I also recommend that they type that out, print it, put it on top of their monitor, and as they're going through developing their presentation, they keep looking up to see, is this where I want to go, or do I change it? It's not locked in concrete, but it gives you a starting point. Mm-hmm. And then in the actual practice, I'm coming, of course, from the military, and anybody who's in the military is going to recognize the term I'm going to use now. I'm a big believer in the murder board. Which is the simulated practice. It started in Army schools. It spread to other services, and it's without anybody who's spent any time in the Pentagon. You say to them murder board, they're going to know what it means. It is, again, I'm going to use an aviation analogy here. It is to the presenter what the flight simulator is to the pilot. And you make your mistakes when they don't count. You get to feel the heat. And then, ideally, when you make your actual presentation, you say, well, I've seen this movie before. And you have anticipated the questions, and you've answered them a lot. When I ran the DIA briefing team for the chairman, we started our first murder board at 5:30 in the morning. Our second one was at 6:30. Our third was at 7:30. And at 8:30, we went up to brief the chairman. And it was a very rare occasion that he had a question that we and our staff had not already anticipated and was able to answer. And when we couldn't answer, we had a great answer for him. It was, I don't know, General, but I'll get that for you. And we got it for him.
Well, yeah, I mean, in a way, the murder board is for you know, somebody doing a presentation at an association meeting, something like that, the physical rehearsal. And it's different than reading your speech several times.
Oh, you don't want to read. Yeah. And when people read their speech over and over in practice, you know, read it. You're going to do it when you get up to do the real thing. You've got to, nothing to matter with using cards. Ronald Reagan spent 8 years as the governor of California and 8 years as the president of the United States. And when he wasn't with a teleprompter, he was using cards. And I stood right beside him over at the in the White House complex when he was giving a presentation, and I was on the same program. And I watched him. His eyes didn't seem to move, but his hands moved and the subject changed. So maybe he had very fast eyes, or maybe he used them as a crutch. But there's nothing the matter with having cards with you. Yeah, but I do not advocate memorizing a presentation. You forget one word and the chain is broken and it's a disaster looming then.
Yeah, no. But, I mean, you've seen me more than a couple of times now. I use the PowerPoints, but I use them as prompts for me. I don't read the PowerPoints. But I need that. Those are my cards.
Yeah, and the less information you have on a PowerPoint slide, the better there is, because you can just turn and glance at it or have it in front of you on your laptop, and it jogs your memory. Mm-hmm. And therefore, it's also not interfering with the audience's comprehension, because when you have too much information on a PowerPoint slide and you're talking at the same time, you're sending counter signals. So you've got to stop a little bit, let them read it, and if you stop too much, maybe you'll never catch them again.
Yeah, yeah, and we both seen slides that just
well,
are
the phrase packed. "Death by PowerPoint" has become part of our vocabulary right now.
Well, there's no white space.
Yeah, that's right. You know, and you want to have white space, just like in a written document.
Yeah, I mean,
I advocate having no more than, and this is the extreme, 40 words on a slide, and that's a little much right there. But I'd say that's the outside limit, and if you can go through with maybe 3 or 4 words in your headline and then not go on to a second line on your bullet, it's a lot easier for the audience to take that in. You pause a little bit for them to take it, but you don't pause that much that you lose them in any way.
Well, let me ask a couple questions about speaking on a stage. Let's say you're on a panel how often does this happen? It hasn't been rehearsed. So you got a moderator and you're sitting there with at least one or two other people, and a general question is thrown out. How do you know when to jump in or literally cut off somebody that doesn't shut up?
Well, I think it's really best if the moderator can take the questions in and then direct it to the person. Otherwise, you've got this confusion up there, and maybe you'll alienate one of your fellow panel members. I was on many, many panels when I was speaking on behalf of the government. And, of course, most of those panels, they were 3 people against me. And incidentally, if anybody listening out here ever gets into a situation like that and you're going to be the lone wolf, talk to the organizer ahead of time and say, listen, rather than me having 25% of the time, I think I should have 50% of the time because I represent 50% of the view and the other 3 people the other. I did that with colleges. I told them, and we made that as a prearrangement, and I went to one college and they told me how they were going to run it, and they weren't going to run it the way they'd agreed to. And I said, okay. I said, I'll go through with it because I'm here now. I said, but I'll guarantee you will never get another speaker from the U.S. State Department. I will blacklist you because you do not agree with you don't live up to your commitments. And they backed off and they went with it that way. The other thing with a panel, you have to watch your body language, especially if there's any conflict arising in there. You don't want to be shaking your head when one of the other people is speaking, sort of a little mild smile or so like that, but none of these things where you're just ridiculing. I see this on television, on the confrontational things on cable,
when they do
a split screen, and the one person, and I even when they're representing my particular political view, I find it rude that they start to shake their head when the other person is speaking.
Right.
They're trying to send a signal, but it goes against our sense of fair play in the United States.
Yeah, and unfortunately, it's becoming more prevalent.
It is, yeah.
And you know, rudeness at large, I'm with you there. I find it ridiculous. One of the first things I teach people on LinkedIn is there's a lot of discussions out there that beg for a snide comment because somebody can't write, there's no verb in the sentence, or they're, you know, just totally off base, wrong comment, wrong group kind of thing. Let it go. Don't comment.
No, don't. Yeah, resist that urge.
So it reflects on you more than on them. They've already shown their lack of understanding for the venue. Don't demonstrate
yours.
That's
right. Don't lower yourself.
Okay. I'm going to throw out another concept here. What about when you're moderating a panel and you have one of those people that just won't shut up?
Well, I think you have to do it with a bit of grace and humor. And you'll say, listen, Tom, that's very, very good. And I think maybe we can discuss that even a little bit more after the program. But let's let Bill have a comment. Bill, what do you say about that? The moderator's got to be the quarterback who controls it. And here's another way in that. When you're having a question from the audience and you have one of these gas bags that keeps going on and on, what you can do is with a slight, and I've used
not,
this.
Not a question.
Yeah, not a question. Just go on and I will say, listen, is there a question in there somewhere? And then go in and say, listen, let me see if I've interpreted this correctly. And then you answer the question then. But you try to shut them off. I used to have people stand up. I was at Cornell University one time speaking with a panel of three people opposed to our policy. And a fellow stood up, gave the power salute. He was in his 40s. He wasn't a student there. He was all in black and like you, Mark, and wearing gold chains. And then when I answered the question, he started to deliver an ad hominem attack on me. And I felt my face get warm. I probably was getting red, and I was about to blow up, maybe. But I said, I can't let you have all the fun. Everybody came here to give me a tough time and just can't let you have all the fun. And I turned away from him and walked to the other side of the stage. He kept on talking. One of the people in the audience said, will you sit down and shut up? We want to get at him, too. I thought that was funny. The audience thought it was funny. He didn't think it was funny, and he goes and runs off. But we had a wonderful discussion after that. It really was, yeah.
The moderator has to have a clue on when and how to stop.
And he ought to set this up ahead of time, establishing what the ground rules will be.
Yeah.
And a lot of times it's better. Here's another thing, too, when you're in a panel and people are asking questions. If you're in this somewhat confrontational or controversial subject, you'll find that some people, towards the end of the presentation, especially if their microphones have been set up in the aisle, they will get up and walk over. I will guarantee you, those are the people who are opposed to the government speaker. So ahead of time, I had that happen one time. After that, I said, rules of the game are, moderator recognizes the questioner, that person walks there, but we don't line up and gang up on it, because that just does not work, especially if you're the government speaker, because you're the one that's going to be the unpopular one, probably.
Okay, you're listening to AmTower Off Center on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. We'll be back after these messages. Welcome back to AmTower Off Center on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Mark AmTower. My guest today is Larry Tracy. Larry is the author of The Shortcut to Persuasive Presentations. Not a long book, but a very powerful book. Get it. Pick it up at Amazon or at Larry's website, tracy-presentations.com.
What, without an S, presentation.
Presentation. Larry, yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
All right. TracyPresentation.com. He has more than one presentation, but let's talk about a couple of quick situations. The classic elevator pitch and its use in an elevator, you know, on public transportation or at a business meeting. So what are the elements of a successful positive experience here?
Well, of course, the system that I spoke about in the previous segment, the 3-1-2 system of organizing, 3 becomes your elevator pitch. That's mm-hmm. one there. And in the military, there is a term, and it's a good term, it's a bad acronym, but it's called bottom line up front. And that's what you want to do. The reason I say there's a bad acronym, the military, we tend to put everything into acronyms, and that comes out as bluff. And I hate that. And I was doing a workshop in the Pentagon a few years ago for officers on the joint staff, majors, lieutenant colonels, Navy equivalents, and an Air Force lieutenant colonel came over at the break and he said, boy, this is really great timing getting this training. He said, because I've got to go up and bluff the chairman tomorrow. I said, what did you say? And then I showed my surprise at that. And he said, oh, you're thinking B-L-U-F-F. No, I mean B-L-U-F. I said, listen to it. Don't say that. You can imagine someone gets out of the military, they're in a company, and they say to one of their coworkers, well, I'm going up to bluff the CEO tomorrow. Well, that reputation is in tatters then.
Right.
But it's time controlled. The old elevator speech is, of course, you get in with the chief executive, and by the time you get to the 14th floor, you've sold him on what a great idea or concept you have. But you have to look at it. What is the essence? And that means editing. You edit down. You come out with what is my main message, and then edit it down so you can get it down to three or four sentences, and then you can expand on it. That's also lends into what I teach, the Plan B presentation. You've got 30 minutes to give a presentation to the CEO. You get there and you find out that he or she has to leave, but they need your information, and you've only got 2 minutes. And what do? You can't very well say, well, I'm sorry, but I can't do this in 2 minutes. You may be done right there. But go in there ahead of time with a plan B. What is the essence of it? And you organize your two cards, the 312, with it as 2A parentheses 1, 2A parentheses 2, et cetera. When you've got to go and shorten your presentation, you merely pull the cards out that have parentheses on them. Mm-hmm. You've retained the essence and the coherence of your presentation, and you're still up, but you don't have all the detail. And you may want to put your slides on a separate CD or memory disk at that point as well, so you don't have to go and jump back and forth. Okay. Incidentally, one little tip on PowerPoint that I don't know where I learned this, because I'm certainly not a PowerPoint expert, but when a question comes up that someone said, could you go back to that slide where you talked about the such and such? And if you have your slides listed on a paper, like 1 through 25, mm-hmm. and you see what it is, you hit that number, then you hit enter, and it jumps right back to it. You don't have to go and hit the back button. And if you've got slides that are just in case slides, they come up on there, and they may be slides 25 to 30, and someone asks a question and say, well, I have a slide that I think will answer that question. You hit 2, 6, enter, and boom, it jumps right to the point.
Okay.
And I have no idea where I learned that. I would give that person credit, but it's a really, I rarely ever find anybody when I'm doing a workshop that knows that, even AV experts.
Okay. Well, AV experts usually aren't presentation experts. So
that's right.
There's your thing. In our market, the rubber meets the road when you win business. Part of winning that business is presenting your ideas to a contracting officer. And a big part of that is the orals.
That's right.
So give me a horror story on somebody screwing up orals.
Biggest problem I find when I work with companies is that, and this goes back to 1997 when FAR Part 15 was changed to make the orals a more robust part of the process, and they said no public speaker, no marketing expert, the technical people who carry out the contract must make the presentation. Now, that put companies into a little bit of a bind because IT and engineers, that's not their comfort zone. But
no,
I think that was right on the part of the government to request that. I worked with a company, a great company, I won't mention its name, just a terrific bunch of people and very enthusiastic. As we were getting ready for it, every idea went onto a whiteboard, and then most ideas wound up on a PowerPoint slide, and all of a sudden, 5 days before the orals, we had 140 PowerPoint slides for a 90-minute presentation. Major surgery had to be done, and I kept thinking, there's a lot of babies being thrown out with bathwater on this. So what I now advocate when an orals is being prepared is to go in with a budget of slides. In other words, if you have a 90-minute presentation, say, all right, we will have no more than 45 slides. And if you want to put anything in more than that, that has to be justified to knock something out. At least that leads to this complete, utter abandonment, and everything goes onto a slide. The other thing is how you orchestrate it and how you get your prime, the project manager, mm-hmm. working with the subs. And maybe I should make it the subs working with the prime. A man who was retired from the energy department told me a story that when he was an evaluator, they were having it down at the Reagan building, and he came in on the metro and then on through the food court. And as he walked through the food court, he saw a group of men, but two of them over there almost looked like they were going to come to blows. And that was so unusual. So he noted it, and he went up and he took his place, and in walks the orals team. And of course, it's these two people in there, all sweetness and light. But he felt, not if they can't carry out a presentation, how are they going to do this complex contract on it? So he did not feel comfortable voting for them. So I think you have to definitely work, practice together, go out and have dinner, get to know each other well. I've heard other stories of people driving in from Falls Church to do a test as to how it would be, say, at the Reagan building, and they came in at 2 o'clock in the afternoon to do their test drive. Mm-hmm. And they find out at 8 o'clock in the morning, it's not quite the same traffic in the Washington area. So these little things, and have an orals coach in there that can really crack the whip if necessary, because you don't want a lot of criticism within the team. This team has to work together, and they have to give that. So during the practice session and the Q&As, that is the area that is constantly ignored. All the oxygen is sucked out of the air in writing the proposal. Then they have a little time left to work on the orals. And we keep saying, we have to have a Q&A because that could be the tiebreaker. Yeah, we have to do that. And all of a sudden, we run out of time. So I think tiebreakers are absolutely essential. Q&As, I should say, to get that ready so you're prepared for the questions.
Okay. Now, your prep time here, I'm assuming you use the murder board concept when you're working with these people.
Yeah.
When you're prepping for any business, how long do you take, how long do you like to take to train a company to do this properly?
Well, if they're, let's take the orals, and that is going to be, you're going to have a finish line, because once the proposal goes in, they don't know when the orals are going to be required. They could say it's going to be anywhere from 3 to 10 days after that. You just have to be ready that you may be the first one to do it. And I don't know whether it's better to be first or last, but I just am such a bug on practicing that I think that once the orals is gone and you can't do any more with it, or the proposal, then you just start to walk through it. You go through it without video for a couple of times to get comfortable. Then video the presentation so you see yourself, you see the team as the presenters, the or evaluators are going to see it. And then you can make those little corrections and little tweaks. And I don't think you can practice too much. There's some say, yeah, but we don't want to leave our fight in the gym. It's not going to be that way. The more you practice, the more that those concepts, those phrases are going to be in your mind. And then when you go to actually do the presentation, it's going to be, as I said before, like you've seen that movie before.
There you go. You're listening to AmTower Off Center on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. We'll be back after these messages. Welcome back to AmTower Off Center on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Mark AmTower. My guest today is Larry Tracy. Again, Larry's book is The Shortcut to Persuasive Presentations. You can get it at Amazon. You can find his papers, and I'll touch on those right now. We have a couple papers up there, Bringing Home the Bacon and Taming Hostile Audiences, and you can find those at tracy-presentation.com. You'll have to send Larry an email. He'll send you the paper, et cetera. But both of them are excellent. You're doing another paper, and I don't know when it's going to be available, but the idea is changing horses in midstream. The idea is you're bidding against an incumbent, and take it from there.
Well, it's it. I have found it finally sort of crystallized in my mind that one of the problems within the oral presentation is there's no job description in the federal government for evaluator for oral presentation. These people are drafted to come in. Now, they may be very, very knowledgeable. They may be the ones working on it. Or they may know nothing about the subject, but they have to fill that chair. And understandably, government evaluators are risk averse. They don't want to be the ones blamed for bringing in the bad company. And I've seen situations like that where it was just known the incumbent was not going to get the job again because of the problems they've had. But the paper that I'm just fiddling around with writing right now is, it's going to be on the basis of, if you're an incumbent, what position should you take to retain that contract? And I think the incumbent should say, even if there, especially if there have been some problems, we've had a few glitches. It's been a very steep learning curve, but now we really know what we're doing. We're working together well, and you certainly don't want a chance of having that whole problem starting over again with someone new. The incumbent or the challenger, on the other hand, should say, I think you don't ignore the fact. You bring it out. We know we're challenging, and we know we're going against an incumbent. And they're possibly going to be telling you, don't change horses in midstream. And we're telling you, you should change horses in midstream because we got a lot faster horse. And bring that up and to do it. I think that's the key. And you have to persuade the evaluators that you can do the job that the government wants, specified in the RFP, even though the RFP is sometimes written in a rather obtuse manner and not sure what it is that they want. Mm-hmm. You have to interpret it, and if you interpret it right, you're gold. If you interpret it wrong, you're dead. But to bring this out, that it is that tipping point, which way do you want to go? Do you want to take a chance with a new one? Do you want to show by past performance that you know how to go through transition? Company, government is very, very concerned about how you go through a transition from an incumbent to a new company coming in. And you've got to show that it will be absolutely seamless. That word is in every proposal, in every oral. It'll be seamless, but I'm not so sure how seamless it really is.
Right.
And I think the evaluators are sometimes a little bit skeptical about that. So you have to show empirical evidence, perhaps from other times when you have transitioned, and getting testimonies from those companies. Boy, this transition was absolutely smooth. We didn't know. Bring all that artillery to bear on it.
You know, one of the things that I like about talking to you is I get juiced watching you speak, because it makes me want to raise my level. but that brings to mind, when somebody's doing this, when somebody's saying you should change horses in midstream, it will be seamless, how important is their tone when they're saying that?
Well, tone of voice is a very important thing, and it becomes a gender difference as well. We men tend to speak in a monotone. Depending on the age of the people that will be in my seminar, I say I blame it essentially on a character in a television program long time ago, Dragnet. That was Detective Sergeant Joe Friday.
Yeah.
I actually have a video clip of he and his partner, and he says, Frank, you got a make on that car? Yeah, Joe, 56 Chevy. And a whole generation of men grew up speaking that way. You got to put emphasis on certain words, verbs especially. And for women, they have a natural inflection in their voice, but sometimes they go just a little bit too high on the scale, and it could be irritating to the ear. And I point out to women in my workshops three role models. That two of them are no longer with us. One is the former congresswoman from Texas, Barbara Jordan, who is a magnificent speaker. The other side of the political spectrum is my professor, my friend, my mentor, Gene Kirkpatrick, who was ambassador in the Reagan administration. And if you listen to a tape of the two of them, you got to listen to the content to know that one is a liberal, one is a conservative, because their voices were so beautiful and so much into the comfort zone of the human ear. And the third, without question, Maya Angelou. I mean, her voice is like a musical instrument when you listen to her.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that women should look towards bringing that tone down a little bit, and inflection down, and or keep the inflection, but bring the tone down. And men should look about putting inflection in, hitting verbs. That's really the key area.
You know, it's funny, because I had a speaking coach in the 90s, Maggie Bedrosian.
I knew Maggie, yeah.
I know you did. And she worked with me for 3 or 4 years. And to put it politely, I used to have a very colorful way of speaking, and she convinced me that that was not necessary given my knowledge base. But the other thing that took a while was getting rid of that monotone.
Yeah.
And once I started feeding off audience energy, modulation came to me.
Also, your gestures. If you use gestures, you almost have to put emphasis into your word. Like, you know, I'm using gestures as I'm talking. Nobody can see me here.
You've been using gestures the whole interview, which is cool.
But if I held my hands down and didn't, it might be difficult, because I would tend to go into that U.S. male tendency of speaking in a monotone, and that can just be so boring.
Or if you're behind a dais, you see those people would grasp the side of the dais.
Well, here's another little tip. You call it a dais, and that's acceptable, but most people call it a podium, and it's actually a lectern. And the way to remember that is you lecture behind a lectern, and you stand on a podium, as a doctor who cares for your feet is a podiatrist.
There you go.
Okay.
I don't know why I call it a day. I always have. But let's get back to orals here. You've coached a lot of companies. I've seen you speak at APMP sessions, other proposal groups. What are the big issues you see as an orals coach?
One of the problems that I see with large companies is that the oral is written, the proposal is written by the proposal people, and once it goes out the door and it makes what the government calls the competitive range, they seem to think that they have scored a victory. And my view is they haven't scored a victory until they get a contract signed and money flows in. And that depends on the technical experts that have to make the oral presentation. And I, in that paper, Bring Home the Bacon, that people can get off the website, or they can send me an email and I'll send it to them, I advocate a four-step process that they get the proposal writer and the project manager together early on, maybe be the proposal manager or the capture manager, when they go to meet the contracting officer so that they can sit down. And there's a possibility, if the RFP hasn't been written yet, that the very knowledgeable project manager may be able to give some suggestions and may be able to shape the RFP so it's in the sweet spot of the company. Yep. Plus just getting that engagement and knowing them and then working together so that when the proposal writers are writing the proposal, those who will be making the oral presentation are sort of looking over their shoulder, picking up little nuggets and also giving technical data. I think it should be, in the military we call it a task force, and I think that's what they should do as opposed to two separate elements that don't come together. And the that is the biggest problem that I find. And when I speak to the Project Management Institute, and I've spoken to four in the last 2 years, I've been told I've spoken to more project management events than anybody else in the last 4 years, I have a very sympathetic ear to my message because they find that they're given a 100-page proposal and given 2 weeks to distill it into a 60-minute presentation. And these are people who speaking skills – they're brilliant people in the technical area, but yep. speaking is not their comfort zone.
Right.
So I think they ought to work together in tandem.
Well, speaking is not most people's comfort zone.
True.
So to wrap this up, give us some final thoughts on speaking and thinking before you speak.
Well, one of the traditional views of speech coaches is that you have to overcome the fear of public speaking. In 1973, the Sunday Times of London came to the U.S. and asked 3,000 Americans, what's your greatest fear? And speaking in front of a group was number one. And death was number four, I believe. And Jerry Seinfeld once used that on the opening of his program. He said, that means that at a funeral, most people would rather be in the coffin than have to deliver the eulogy. Well, I figure I'm going to steal that line, which I do. I disagree with that concept. I think you should use and channel that nervousness. Do it in such a way that it is converted almost in a chemical way to enthusiasm and engagement where you relate to it. Don't try to go and practice so much that you, and I'm here I semi contradicting it, you think you'll memorize and therefore you'll take care of that nervousness. That won't work. So use the nervousness, and the more you present, the more you go through it, the more you hear questions coming from your simulated audience in the murder board, the more you're going to be comfortable till you reach that tipping point, to use Gladwell's term, that all of a sudden you say, I just can't wait to give this presentation because I know this subject better than anybody, and you've been tested with those questions. And I think that's my main area. And then videotape. Videotape your presentation. When I do the murder boards for companies getting ready for orals, after about the first or second presentation, we videotape everything. Then we take a look at it. And we tweet, just like game films for an athletic team. And you look at it and you see, and they see themselves how the evaluators will see them. They hear their voice the way the evaluators will hear them. And that's where the tweaking comes in. And so there's the areas that I think that really people can pick up on.
And this is the John Madden of speaking that I'm speaking with here.
So. I ought to do a video game on it, right?
There you go. Larry, thanks so much for coming in. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Mark.
This is not my day job. If you need coaching on LinkedIn, we touched on that briefly here. Give me a shout. I'm also running I run the Government Market Master Program at Capital College, where we offer classes, continuing professional education in the areas of sales, marketing, business development, social media, and actually managing a government business. We hope to have Larry as one of our instructors. Thank you so much for listening to AmTower Off-Center on Federal News Radio.
You've been listening to AmTower Off-Center on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear it in its entirety on our website, federalnewsradio.com. AmTower Off-Center, Monday afternoons at noon, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM, WFED, your source for federal news now.